Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod, and we have a great interview lined up today. Celsea CEO Jose Dos Santos. Jose, thank you for making the time.
Good morning, Duncan. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, this podcast flows from a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago when you announced your results. You were just next door here in the Celsea boardroom, and you came out in strong defense of the white paper, the integrated ICT policy white paper from government, and particularly the wholesale open access network component thereof. Now, your colleagues over at Vodacom and MTN are very critical of this white paper, and they're particularly opposed to the idea of this WOAN, and particularly the idea of it being a monopoly, monopoly over infrastructure, which is the proposal contained in the white paper. And I'd like to, we're going to talk in a lot of detail in this podcast about that white paper, your views of the of this wholesale open access network, why you think it's a good idea for the industry. But before we get to that, it's not often I get to sit down with you, Jose, and have a lengthy conversation about the industry and where it's going. And I thought, let me take a bit of advantage and ask you to maybe talk a little bit about Jose Dos Santos. You've been at Celsea as CEO now for, I think, about 3 years. Is that right?
Yeah, Duncan, it was effectively in the second quarter of 2014. Just after Alan, fell ill.
So, yes.
You know, we all came into Celsea in 2012. It was part of the new team, the new restructure with Alan. And, yeah, it's been a good journey. Tough, you know, a lot of sleepless nights, but the rewards were there. And, you know, the financials that we posted for last year show the commitment of the team and the vision and exactly what our strategy was. So it's been a rewarding and satisfactory position to be in, to really lead a team like this. We really have a phenomenal team, and the results are paying dividend.
So I want to talk about those results just now, and also the recapitalization of the business, which is fundamental to its future. But have you always been in telecommunications, Jose? What's your background?
All my life.
All your life. Where did you start out?
Listen, you're making me sound old now, so I've got to be careful what I say. But, I mean, I started off, you know, I came from a family of, you know, electrical engineers and then sort of electronic engineering. But I didn't pursue that as much as the family wanted me to. I actually became, you know, a salesman of electronic goods, you know, in the telco space as a PABX. You know, I qualified as an electronic technician, but then sort of moved on. And then really, you know, I worked for Alcatel and Altron at that stage. And then sort of in 1993 when GSM was the buzzword, you know, within Altron we started Autopaid Cellular, the service provider, if you recall.
I do.
Yeah, and that's where I sort of moved from one division into another and sort of grew from there and been in telco all my life.
Okay. And you most recently, before joining Celsea, you were CEO of Vodacom in Mozambique if I recall correctly. You've always been quite close to Alan, not Craig. And that's how your entry into Celsea happened, right?
So, yeah, when I was the managing director of Autopaid Cellular, we sold both products for MTN and Vodacom, so I knew both CEOs and I knew Alan well. And then I first landed up in Tanzania. I was the CEO of Tanzania for a year. And I think they worked out that I spoke Portuguese, so I landed up in Mozambique. If only they knew the truth. But that's for another day.
Okay. Yeah. So then what happened? How did you come across to Celsea? Did Alan phone you up and offer you a job?
Well, my contract was coming to an end. Mm-hmm. I spent 9 years with Vodacom, you know, Tanzania and Mozambique. Mm-hmm. And we built two great businesses there. And my contract was coming to an end, and Alan was getting out of retirement.
Yes.
He was pretty bored. You know, he had spent 4 years, I think it was, at home, give or take. And, you know, Celsea was in really, really a difficult situation in 2012. And, you know, we were approached to talk to the existing shareholders. and asked whether we wanted to take on this challenge and see what we could do. And that's how it really came about, building a new team. And it was, you know, sort of a three-stage approach. You know, the first stage was, can we actually fix this business and what was wrong with it? And that took the best part of 18 months, really looking at systems, people, structure, culture. And then really getting the consumer confidence back. You know, that was a real challenge. You know, after, say, in 2012, the company was, what, let's say 11 years old by that time, with a really sort of bitter taste in consumers' minds. So it was hard work getting that perception turned around and offering some value back to the consumer. And then the third stage is where we are now in the recapitalization program. So we have, you know, a very strong income statement and a very weak balance sheet. And this is what this recapitalization is about, really getting the balance sheet back into a structure that is, you know, well geared, and we can go out there and really compete. We've had a good 3 years of good growth competition out there. And once the restructure program takes place, puts Celsi in a very, very far better position to also continue to compete, but more importantly, bring a whole new array of products and services to market, which would have been very difficult for us to do, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago.
Well, let's talk about those numbers, because you published your annual results a couple of weeks ago in more detail than you ever have in the past. I suppose my first question is, why publish that level of information? You're a private company. Is this the first stage of heading towards a listing potentially?
Yeah, so Duncan, I think it's a twofold approach. I mean, part of this restructuring, we're bringing in two new equity partners in, you know, Blue Label and NetOne. Blue Label listed in South Africa, NetOne listed South Africa, NASDAQ. And I think the people want some more transparency about who Celsi is. They certainly get questioned why they're investing in this organization. And I think the time was appropriate to, you know, become, when I say transparent, at the same level playing field as the other incumbents in South Africa. You know, the other three incumbents are listed entities, so they tend to disclose their results in that same manner. And we thought, well, let's put the results out there for, you know, an apple-for-apple comparison. And that's it. But also, to your point, you know, I've been vocal about it, and I think the new equity partners have the same view. You know, we prepared ourselves for a listing, and we hope to achieve that in a reasonable time frame.
So talk about these annual results that you published for the 2016 financial year. You reported a net profit, I think it was 400 and something million rand.
450. 450 odd.
Yeah, million rand. A big swing, a big turnaround in the financial picture. How did you actually do it?
Well, you know, it comes down to revenue growth. I think, you know, people tend to look at the bottom line, but let's start at the top line. You know, we really, as I said earlier, had to focus at all levels. You know, our customer service had to change, our distribution strategy had to change, our value proposition had to change. And I think once you get the revenue, then you looked at efficiencies. So, you know, we really went through the OPEX side and the capital expenditure side and maximized the efficiencies and really built a business that has a good ratio in terms of revenue to, you know, cost and, you know, ultimately give you the bottom line. So if you look at our EBITDA growth, was a good, healthy EBITDA growth, and, you know, at the EBIT level. At the net income level, a larger combination of Forex swing, because, you know, we've had that benefit as our debt, because our debt was all, it still is, you know, in foreign currency. So that's really the major swing from, I think it was the minus 6 to plus 450. But yeah, overall, good, healthy results. You know, and we look forward to this year, and I'm not going to give too many forward-looking statements, but so far the first quarter has been a healthy quarter under difficult trading circumstances. I mean, we mustn't kid ourselves. You know, we have huge challenges from an economical point of view.
Indeed. So the recapitalization of the business, you've got Blue Label Telecoms coming in now as a significant minority shareholder, taking 45% of the business under the proposed restructuring. How did the discussion around the recapitalization get started? Who approached who? How did Blue Label get involved? I know they've always been close to Celsi, and the Levy brothers historically have been very good friends with Alan, not Craig, and yourself. But how did this discussion, what was the starting point? What was the germination point for this restructuring? Who actually raised the discussion of reducing this debt and getting these shareholders on board?
I think it has been there for a while. I mean, when we arrived, when Alan and I first started in the business, we knew that the balance sheet had to be fixed.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just as simple as that. the question was, could you actually get the income and the, you know, the income the actual P&L statement generating good revenue and good profit. So right from, I would say, probably 2014, Blue Label and us were in discussions and saying, you know, what's your future, Blue Label? What's our future? And I think more importantly, you know, the culture fits. So you start off by saying, do I really want to have you as an equity partner? And if the culture fits, you tick that box. Then you say, well, do you have the money to play in this league? And, you know, you tick that box. So they said, well, we have the money to invest. And then you say, well, how do we maximize our synergies going forward? And where does that put Blue Label and where do we go? And then it comes down to, you know, where's CELSI going over the next 3-4 years? And where the, you know, Blue Label believes in that strategy, believes in where management is taking it. And it's sort of been quite a long process to the point that eventually, you know, sort of middle 2015, you know, we started deep discussions. And by December 2015, when we made the first announcement, that Blue Label was interested in taking an equity share in the company. So I think it wasn't, you know, it definitely wasn't a 6-month process. It was years of sitting down and talking and saying, where are they going? You know, and also Blue Label strategically, they're looking for other sources of revenue. They also diversify into other areas of their company other than just distribution of vouchers. So also very successful business. And they're looking at where they're going to position themselves. And, you know, CELSI for them was a good strategic partner to get involved in.
You mentioned synergies from a CELSI perspective. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to what the synergies are from a Blue Label perspective, but specifically from a CELSI perspective, what does Blue Label bring to the party apart from a pot of cash?
Well, look, Blue Label provides a service to most of the incumbents, you know, in terms of distribution of vouchers. So that is, you know, key. And I mean, they've been vocal about that, and they will continue to be independent and be an aggregator to all networks. But I think people underestimate what Blue Label does when it comes to distributing vouchers. You know, it's a big industry. It's a huge volume of revenues that are flowing, and they manage that very well in making sure that vouchers are available at, you know, most street corners across the country, that the consumer, you know, can get access to all products from any network. And as I said, I think people underestimate what they really do for the industry. And there's only probably 2 or 3 people of that magnitude that can actually do that in the successful way that they've done. So for us, you know, without distribution, you're really not in the game. You know, that's key.
But you were distributing through them already. They still need to treat their other mobile partners fairly. Can they actually can they give you special favors that they perhaps can't give to the rivals?
Not at all. I think, you know, those commercial agreements are tied in with, you know, with all the operators, so there's no special favors. I think the synergies from Blue Label, what they give us, is really the strategic intent of where we're taking the company going forward.
Okay.
And, you know, unfortunately, I won't elaborate too much on that.
All right.
But I think the next 6 months we'll see where certain value that they have, certain value we have, and once we marry those two together, you'll see a whole different bouquet of products and services being taken to market. And it's really understanding, you know, the role that they're going to be playing and what they can do for us.
So it's a strategic, it's more of a strategic input that they're going to be providing into the future of this business, and their deep understanding of mobile distribution that, that's going to help with the strategy of CELSI.
Yeah, and they also have 1 or 2, you know, businesses. You know, I hate referring them to IT business, but they have software business that they've involved, their development business that they have. And we've partnered with one or two of them, looking forward to how they fit in and what value they can provide us. And I think this is where the exciting part is. So, you know, come around August, September, I think we're going to see some of the new creative things being, you know, brought to market.
Okay. So as part of the capital restructuring, the intention is to get the net debt of the company to below 6 billion rand from somewhere north of 20 billion rand at the moment. 23 billion rand at the moment.
Depends on the exchange rate, but it's just used 23.
Which this morning it's heading the wrong direction, unfortunately. But 6 billion rand, to me, still looks like a heck of a lot of debt, but I imagine much more easy to service, much more manageable.
Well, you know, the way the 6 billion rand was derived was you had to build a business case that says you can service that debt.
Of course.
I mean, the reason we, you know, it's a restructure situation is because the company couldn't service the old debt.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do. You have to restructure the balance sheet. So, you know, if you look at our forecasts and our growth and our business case going forward, then 6 billion rand is debt that we can service. And don't forget, you'll probably increase that a little bit with your capital expenditure over the next 5 years. say you'll probably land at about 8, you know, 9, give or take. And that's really where you're going to be sitting. And then, you know, with the revenues, the EBITDA growth, the free cash flow situation, you can service the debt. And that's what it's really all about, you know, having a ratio that is manageable.
Yes, yes. There was some, maybe just for some clarity, Jose, a couple of weeks ago, or maybe even a couple of months ago now, the ratings agencies put out a report saying that there was some, that CLC failed to honor certain repayment commitments in terms of its obligations. What happened there? And
well, so, you know, we have five lenders, you know, that are part of the 23 billion or so debt.
Yeah.
And one of them is bondholders. So there's a bond that was there. And obviously it was a public bond. And when we took the decision to restructure, you don't service the commitments of debt that you have. So what they did is just natural course of business. So, you know, if you don't service the bond, they have to make a statement that they're going to downgrade you. So it was just, you know, normal course of business because we didn't service that bond. Post recapitalization, you'll probably find that there'll be a new rating, which will be a favorable rating.
Okay.
And I think a lot of, you know, individuals in the media overreacted to that. But if you actually understood it, it's just a normal process of business. You had to re-rate it. If you don't get paid, you can't have a good rating. You have to have a bad rating.
Okay. You know? Okay. So I think some institutional investors were hoping that Telkom would buy CLC. You never seemed terribly keen on that idea. But would consolidation between operators in this industry not have made it a bit easier to compete, three big operators instead of four?
Yeah, look, I think competition is what we need. You know, the argument of consolidation we're going to go into a bit later in this interview, which is really the one, and my views on that. So let's not get confused between infrastructure sharing and consolidation of, does infrastructure give you, you know, an advantage when, as opposed to today versus 20 years ago? And we'll get into that sort of discussion later. But we need, in my view, more competition in this country. So I don't think it would have been a good fit. And at the end of the day, you know, it's public knowledge there. You know, they put in an offer and we reject it for obvious reasons. We have legal agreements with Blue Label in place.
Right.
But also, you know, the valuation is not what one thinks. So if they were serious about it, I think they'd have been more serious in what they wanted to do. And they had the opportunity over the last 2 years. So, you know, difficult to comment. I don't believe that the merger would have been a successful merger. You know, really from a South African consumer point of view.
You mentioned cultural fit with Blue Label. Would there have been a cultural fit with Telkom or not?
Look, it's difficult for me to comment. You know, I don't know Telkom that well, but, sure. You know, I'm not sure how they would do it. Would they consolidate the two? Would they leave the CLC brand, take Telkom brand? What would they do with the staff? Difficult to comment at this stage, but I mean, I think one just needs to look forward and move on.
Yes.
And, you know, we're moving on, and I think from a consumer point of view, it's fantastic that CLC will remain.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Other people may have a different view, but they're entitled to that opinion.
I suppose it's whether your view is that this market can sustain four operators or whether there should be some sort of consolidation.
I think after the chat, you know, for your audience and people who listen to the podcast, and if they really get to understanding of how the industry works, I think there's room for another one or two or three players.
Okay.
I mean, let's just look at CLC. We've got MVNOs, we've got FNB Connect, we've got Mr. Price. They all play a role. They all get in their subscribers. Those subscribers are happy with their service providers. They add their value that they like. So it comes in different forms, you know. We mustn't get stuck and say, well, a network's a network and every network must have their own infrastructure. You know, there's other people that are known as networks that sell services and they don't have infrastructure. And yet we see more competitiveness. It's helping the pricing coming down. And so that's all good for the South African consumer at large.
All right. Well, I think that's a neat way into talking about the ICT policy white paper and specifically to talk about the wholesale open access network. Your big rivals appear much less keen on the idea than you do. At least as proposed in the white paper, that it be some sort of infrastructure monopoly. Surely, Jose, monopolies are a bad idea. Have we not learned the lesson from Telkom?
Yeah. Look, I think what I'd like to clarify right up front is two things, you know, in this discussion. And let's divide this into two scenarios, if I may. One is, how does the industry work? In other words, how does it affect investors that invest in networks like CLC and the other incumbents? And how we manage that so that we give a return to our investors and we keep getting investors to fund our growth. And then there's what we expect to achieve as a South African, you know, platform in sense of broadband. In other words, what do we really want to achieve? And we go back to the old 2020 vision, which is now we're getting really close to, you know, 2020 with 3 years to go. And what do we want to achieve for the South African consumer, specifically, you know, in the outlying areas? And that's how we got to look at this whole thing. So let's attack the first issue. You're asking me monopolies. Monopolies are not good for anyone. Okay. So today you have two incumbents that are saying, well, I want to protect what I already have. I built this infrastructure. It's mine and it gives me a competitive advantage. And that's the position they have and that's their opinion. Fine. Where we come from, we say it's not a competitive advantage to have this infrastructure any longer. Okay. It was 20 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. Today, if you take into account where the new technologies are going, and we're still a very early country in 4G, if you look at 5G and you look at that expense and the technologies, you say, well, what is the return on investment on those capital layouts, number one? Secondly, you look at the spectrum issue, which has been a massive debate. You know, when you start looking at 5G technologies where you need huge bands of spectrum, 55, 60 megahertz, and I don't want to confuse your audience with all the technical jargon, but when you look at the spectrum that's available and then you start, you know, dividing that in four or five equal parts, because you now really have, you know, another operator coming on stream shortly, WBS. So when you start taking that spectrum and dividing five, you're actually not gaining the efficiencies that you want out of 5G. So the consumer experience will then not be as what they potentially perceive that 5G will be. Therefore, you can't monetize it to the level that you should be. So if we go through the arguments very slowly, we say, well, let's look at infrastructure sharing first. How in the world do we actually ever achieve, you know, what we want to achieve in the rural areas if we don't build one massive network? And this is where the one, you know, agreement has come about, where the industry with the ministry and then the white paper, where we're very supportive, we're saying what we're trying to achieve is not taking your existing technologies of 2G, 3G, and 4G and sharing it. We're talking about a really broadband network, and let's refer to it as 5G, going forward and saying build this massive network. All the industry players can have equity if they want. We can go and fund this business separately. It should be run by the private sector, in my view. And there's the one or two things we don't agree with the white paper. Issues like that should be addressed. And then go out there and compete on services. And so that's the first debate one needs to understand. You know, input costs are going up. Labor costs are going up. How would we ever bring affordable data costs to consumers if we keep duplicating, quadrupling, and even now going five times around with WBS on infrastructure costs? So I don't see that price coming down as rapidly as it should do, unless you eliminate, you know, the input costs totally to an extent that you become truly efficient. So dominant players will always want to protect what they have. New players come in and say, you know, let's do it. So the debate then becomes, well, you know, you hear people say it hasn't worked anywhere else in the world. Really? Okay, so let's just take that opinion for a moment and say, okay, it hasn't worked in the world. Why are we as South Africans always being so negative that we can't create a new model, that we become the reference? Why do we always have to say, well, there's no reference in the world, said one work? I mean, just take the example of Chris Bonnard. Imagine he said, well, no one's ever done open heart surgery or done a heart transplant, said one work. I mean, we have so many South African successes.
Let me play the devil's advocate for a moment. What if it doesn't work?
But it will work. Are you saying South Africans, we don't have the capacity and the brain power and the knowledge to make a model work to achieve the objectives that we want as South Africans? Why wouldn't it work? Are you telling me that we don't have the enough intelligence?
It might not work because the model might be fundamentally flawed.
How can it be fundamentally flawed? Because the objective is to reduce input costs, to have one network. Let me just give it to you this way, and I've said this before, and for our audience. Two examples. Imagine the financial institutions, all the banks had to outlay their own ATMs. And every street corner had 12 different ATMs, and your debit card or your credit card could only work on your branded bank that you use. You couldn't multi-share ATMs. So they found that model. Take the manufacturing, auto industry. They share platforms, chassis, they share engines, they share transmissions, they share suspensions. And then they compete on the value, the brand, the quality of the car. And they find engineering ways to differentiate themselves between one motor vehicle and another. If they didn't do that, what do you think a basic car would cost? Maybe R1 million, R2 million for a basic motor car. But they share those costs.
Those are commercial decisions that those companies have made based on analyzing the market, the need to create efficiencies, etc. What's being proposed in the white paper is that the government forces a monopoly infrastructure environment by closing out the possibility of licensing radio frequency spectrum on an exclusive use basis to any operator. Is the danger not that we're forcing a model on an industry where not every industry player agrees and where other industry players believe the better model is exclusive use spectrum? And clearly Vodacom and MTN are subscribed to that model and want their own spectrum.
Well, you know, let's give the ministry and the DOC, the Department of Communications, a fair chance. They put out a draft white paper. You know, it's for us as an industry and people at large to comment. And there are flaws on the white paper. Mm. Let's be honest. And we work closely with the ministry to change those. So that was the advent. Mm. As a result of the white paper, that's when we came out with what we call the one wireless open access network document.
So the hybrid model.
Correct. There's a document that the industry players have signed that eliminates those, where we say, you know, we will put the majority of spectrum or the necessary spectrum into this entity, which will leave some spectrum still for the independent people who wish to have access to that. We will, you know, exercise our right to use 30% of that capacity, so which means that that model then becomes
viable.
A viable financial model, which you can then go and borrow money from foreign investment or local investment and build this model. So this is the point I'm trying to say, Duncan. I think we have, you know, the knowledge, the know-how as South Africans to find a model that works for us as South Africans with the view of bringing cost, you know. You interviewing me today as CEO of Cell C, tomorrow, you know, my time will come, I'll move on, and I'm just a consumer. I want that affordability to be there to all consumers. Because at some point in time, I also just want to be a consumer that accesses this broadband network.
But if there's only one monopoly provider, surely there's no incentive for it to keep its prices down.
No, no. It's an infrastructure model.
Mm-hmm.
So this entity will be an entity that, by the way, all operators can have equity in there if they wish, or you have a new entity of investment coming through, local or foreign. But there's nothing stopping the incumbents to decide, well, I want to have a stake of that pie.
Mm.
And whether you own 5 or 10 or 15% equity, that's entirely up to your appetite. What that company does is regulated by, you know, where are the technology trends going? What are the requirements? What are the service level agreements that we do? And has an open access that is identical to anyone who wants to use that network. What you then have, what I foresee happening, is maybe 7 or 8 operators or 9 or 10 operators competing on services. We all have access to this infrastructure. It's one cost, you know, well managed, well maintained, and we all compete. So I see more competition coming. And we've seen this in, not in the sense of having one infrastructure entity in Europe, but we've seen multiple players in Europe. And what you're seeing today, you in India, you know, and you see in other countries in Europe, people are starting to merge organizations because they just can't carry these costs. And what is a merger? Well, it's really the creating efficiencies of your network.
Mm.
Yes. Ultimately, efficiency of your staff.
Mm.
So what we're saying is, well, let's really create an infrastructure company that all people can utilize on a very effective basis. I mean,
so
I don't know if it makes sense to you, but I mean,
I guess my next question is, if all the operators and new players like internet service providers, I know that there are other companies interested in playing in this market, and Dealing Hub is busy with some ventures. Irene Charnley at Smile Communications is interested in getting into this space. And there's a whole array of internet service providers who are keen to get access to spectrum as well. If they all become participants or investors in this wholesale open access network, how, with a huge range of investors involved, how are you ever going to reach agreement on what to do?
You don't have to be an investor because, you know, to build a network of that nature, you're talking tens and tens of billions of rands.
Sure.
You don't have to be an investor. You just get access to the network.
Mm.
So that is everyone's ultimate decision. But in, like any organization, if you had 6 or 10 investors, you then have a board, and the board is there to service to ensure that we have the right technology, the right efficiency, and the right costs. Mm. That's the way it's going to be managed, like any other business. Mm. I don't foresee 10 or 20 investors. Sure. I foresee maybe potentially 4 or 5 key investors will raise the money to build this network.
And it'll be the big infrastructure providers that exist today, Cell C, MTN, Vodacom, Telkom.
You could have companies like American Towers may be interested. You could just have venture capitalists who believe that this is a good investment and they invest in it. Yep. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that we as incumbents would invest in it. Yep. I mean, one would have to look at it and say, do I just want to have access to the open access and pay my fee to access that network, or do I want to have an equity stake at the top in the infrastructure business?
Mm. Now, the different operators at the moment make different decisions about technology rollouts. At the end of the day, it's all 3G or 4G LTE, but there's a lot of nuance in there. If I go and speak to the CTO at Vodacom and then I go and speak to the CTO here at Cell C, they probably have quite a different view of how to build a network, including technology choices. And we all know how engineers can argue about technology decisions. Is this just not going to be a recipe for a huge argument over which particular technology choices to make?
Well, let me ask you the question. Mm. At the end of the day, is there really a difference on the technologies from a consumer experience? Consumer one.
From a consumer experience perspective, there isn't. But there are nuances
and
in the network.
Who are we at a service? The consumer and the shareholder. Mm. So whoever CTO you appoint in this company or multiple CTOs that ultimately participate, they will then make the decision of what technology to use, and they'll make the right decision to use and say, well, here's the standard. We're going 5G, but we're going to use this vendor or that approach as opposed to this approach or that approach. Mm. At the end of the day, the consumer on any incumbent accesses the internet on one way or another. Mm. What you have to not forget, which is more important than the technology, is the quality of service. Mm. So you have to ensure that you have the right quality of service that the consumer experiences across the nation. Mm. And that is a totally different debate in the sense of rather technology, because then it comes down to spectrum. Mm. If you've got, let's call it today, we talk the 700, 800 meg spectrum that is sitting with the broadcaster, and I stand to correction, I think there's about 120 or 130 megs there. If you start dividing that by 6, 7 operators, then you're just going to degrade the service that the consumer experiences. It's no different today, really, between 4G and 3G. What's the difference? Mm. It's marginal. It's another 20, 30 megabits download, where it should be 70 or 80 megabits per second download difference between 3G and 4G. Mm. Why don't you get that? Lack of spectrum.
Let me play devil's advocate again.
Sure.
MTN and Vodacom would probably argue. In fact, I know they argue this point. They say that Cell C is interested in this open access model because it doesn't have the funds to build a national network. It doesn't invest the same amount in capital expenditure on an annual basis, and so it can't build a network of national scope that can compete with what they're doing. And they therefore argue that Cell C has no other choice but to pool its funds in a wholesale network to try and build that network to compete with the network infrastructure that they are rolling out. Is that fair criticism or not?
But then this is, Duncan, you're just going into the bait. Then by doing that, you're just trying to monopolize the industry. Who says a network has to have a network infrastructure? Why can't I lease it from someone? Isn't that why mobile virtual networks exist today? There's some very successful MVNOs in the world, including South Africa. Mm. FNB Connect's a huge success. Mr. Price, huge success. So who says you have to have this infrastructure? And the answer is no. I don't want to, offload my capital investment to someone else, because ultimately I have to pay to access that service. Mm. So that's the wrong argument. If I don't have a network, I still have to pay somebody to access that network. I still have to pay a price per minute and a price per meg. So you're recovering your cost of network. It's a question of where do you want to position yourself, and does one entity do a better job than six? Look what we have today from an infrastructure. Everyone is trying to build coverage in a certain area, and everyone's racing there to build 10 towers when you could have built 4 and given you the service. Everyone's digging up, putting their own fiber, so you have 5 fiber links when you could have only had 1, which would have serviced and given you exactly the same level. And those are the efficiencies we're looking for. Mm. So, of course, the dominant operators want to put their position. They want the cake for themselves. Mm. You have two dominant operators who just want to have the entire cake. If it wasn't for Cell C or Telkom Mobile, for that matter, would the pricing per minute or per meg be what it is today? I'm asking you the question. The answer is no.
No.
Exactly. So why are we so afraid of competition? Why are the dominant operators afraid? The network infrastructure is really just about efficiencies. It is no longer, well, in my view, it is no longer a differentiating fact in the world. And we see this in Europe. You know, when you go and sit at the World GSM Congress and you speak to the other operators, they say, well, you know, a network's a network now. Coverage is coverage. Everyone's got the same coverage.
How does this wholesale network get regulated? It's going to have an infrastructure monopoly, particularly in the rural areas. The network operators, Cell C included, I'm sure will continue to roll out infrastructure based on exclusive use spectrum in the urban areas. But in areas where it doesn't have any competition, the natural inclination, as we've seen in this industry in the past, is for prices to creep higher and for monopoly practices to emerge. How do you police that? Does the industry do it, or do you now have to get ICASA or some other regulator in to set prices?
Well, today, here's the interesting question. So today what you have is you have the regulator who regulates the wholesale price per minute, which we know as mobile terminating rates, okay? But there's no mobile terminating rate on data.
No.
Okay? So if you're talking about, in this debate about the WAN, it's really only about building a broadband network, right?
Yeah.
So you're building this. Each incumbent of operators will carry their own voice. I see that happening for many years to come. So we're purely talking about building this huge data infrastructure network that we do. So the regulator would just regulate on wholesale price. So, and I'll use an example. I mean, there's a lot of debate and discussion that has to go. They would set a price and say, this is what you pay that company per petabyte, as an example. So each operator said, well, if I consume a petabyte, that's what I pay you. How you then package that petabyte in different segments, in different gigs to the consumer? Well, that's the differentiator of each organization. But that's what the regulator would do. It says, look, this is the price per petabyte, 100 petabytes, 200 petabytes, whatever you consume. So when you get to that level, that's your cost. And it'll give everybody the same level playing field to go out there and grow their market. So if one incumbent goes and sells 100 petabytes, that's their price. If another one goes and only got 10 petabytes, well, that's their price. But you're competing for the same consumer on the same level playing field. So this is not fixed in concrete. This is not where it's going. This is just suggestions that we're having with the DOC, you know, and the ministry saying, okay, well, that's how you'd regulate it. But it would be almost as simple as that. It sounds complex, but it's not.
Is it desirable, though, to have a regulator set prices?
Well, you know, whether you like it or not, you're in a regulated industry.
Sure, okay. But retail prices are not regulated. You're
yes,
proposing
and,
that retail
and
prices
we would not go. No,
these
I'm
are
not
the retail prices to companies.
No. These are retail. I'm referring to the wholesale price from the infrastructure company to us as incumbents.
Right.
Okay, which is referred to as a wholesale price.
A wholesale price, okay.
We determine the retail price, and the retail price would then be very, you know, competitive, I think, if you had 10 or 12 players out there, like we've seen today. So by no means are we saying, absolutely, categorically not, do you regulate retail price.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But regulating that wholesale price, is that desirable, or should that price be set as a negotiation between the operators? And I suppose if you do that, there's the risk of being accused of collusion.
Well, today you've got the same thing with mobile terminal ratings. There's a price that's set by the regulator.
Yeah.
They go through intensive studies and they determine a price and the industry abides by it.
That's a different price, though. That's an interconnection fee. It's not a wholesale price charged directly to the operator.
Well, you'd have to do the same cost-based study. What is your investment? Mm. How does that company make a return? Mm. What is a fair price to charge for access? Whether you regulate it, whether it's a combination of commercial input from the incumbents and the regulator, I think this is, you know, the process that one has to go through. I don't think there's a clear-cut answer now, but it'll have to, what has to happen, it has to be fair and transparent and the same for all. Whatever that price ultimately becomes, how you've determined it, you know, whatever, you know, cost model you've used, it has to be the same for all. That's what we're saying.
Mm. Are we not rushing into a model here that might have unintended consequences down the line?
Look, every model, every business has consequences. It's how you manage them.
But we're going all in here.
Yeah, but at the same, what is the alternative? So
infrastructure competition.
Well, let's address that infrastructure competition. Now you're going to go out there, and so let's address the first part of that. Mm. What do we do with our spectrum? Let's assume, for the purpose of this discussion, Duncan, that the spectrum is available, which it's not. Okay, we still have to go through that process of releasing that spectrum from the broadcasters and putting it back into mobile operators. But for the purpose of this discussion, let's assume that the spectrum is available. What do you do? Well, you know, how do you allocate that spectrum?
It is scarce, so you'd have to divvy it up and find a mechanism for awarding it to the operators that can make most effective use of it, which I guess is what ICASA was proposing to do through its auction.
Well, you're just taking competition away. Why would you peg a price? And let's just use the past example. There's 3 billion rand, okay, to people who want to get into the market but don't have that investment.
Mm.
So how are you going to increase competition?
Isn't the way to do that? I mean, I'm paraphrasing really summarizing here what ICASA was proposing to do, but they were proposing to create an MVNO model where the networks open up their infrastructure on a wholesale basis to third parties and to propose to regulate it from that perspective. So they continue to build the infrastructure. We continue to have infrastructure competition, but the market is opened to new players through a wholesale model.
Well, it's not exactly how it was intended. You know, first you were going to bid, you were going to take the spectrum, and then you were going to get into discussions, okay, and hope for the best. So I don't think one can do that. So, you know, from our view, it is a scarce commodity. Why would you want to divvy it up?
Yeah.
Why don't you just build this massive, great network? So we've debated that. Let's look at the other alternative. We've never paid for spectrum in this country before. Why should we start paying for it now? You just set a tone for the, you know, established dominant operators to get ahead. So why are you issuing license to, you know, Cell C, Telkom Mobile, potentially Smile, when they don't have the same level playing field to compete? I mean, let's not forget that Cell C, when we started in 2012, we had to go to court to address the MTRs. Because Cell C, for the first 11 years, had no fair level playing field in the MTRs. And when we got that right, look what started happening. We could compete effectively. So one has to look at that. It's a very fine balance between what you're trying to achieve. If you're trying to make dominant operators more dominant and you want two or three in this market and you look at the world as an operator, then proceed on that basis. And then in 10 years' time, we'll sit here. I'll be much older. And we won't have achieved the effect of what we're trying to do for consumers. Or you find a model that works for this country, and says, what is the cost of bringing, you know, data costs down? It's only your input cost. I mean, this is the ironic part. Why is everyone so reluctant to disclose what the total input costs are with the four or five incumbents? Let's just go. We always say, oh, we're building infrastructure. Isn't it sad that we're taking money and duplicating infrastructure when we could use those same funds to put it back into the consumer's pocket? You know, at the moment, everyone says, well, you know, analysts and the incumbents say, I spent 20 billion rand, and the other one says I spent 15, the other one says I spent 10. You could have spent half and achieved the same objective.
There is that cost argument, but by the same token, you could argue that infrastructure competition is good. For example, if this WoWAN goes down, no one is left with an alternative because there is only one provider.
Today's technology is so much redundancy. You know, for it to go down, may go down for an hour or two. I mean, the redundancy on how you build networks. Today, when you go down in an area, you go down 30, 40 sites at max. You've got 10,000 sites. So the impact is minimal.
I've seen sites go down. I mean, my work has been affected, but I just switch on another dongle and I switch to another network and carry on working. I wouldn't
still have that facility. You may go from, at that stage, from 5G back to 4G. So you'll be on this great national broadband network using 5G as an example. And if it goes down, you'll still have all the other incumbents like Cell C and the other incumbents that will continue to offer 4G and 3G. So maybe for an hour, you go from 100 meg download speed to 50 or 40. So you still have that. I mean, it's not as to say that the 4Gs and 3G technologies of the existing incumbent are going to shut down. By no means. I don't think that's any incumbent's intention, certainly not ours. And I don't think, I can't speak for the others, but I don't think they'll shut those networks down either.
So this, the industry has proposed, it's through Deloitte, right, that this document's been put together. There's the industry, all the main operators have signed this document, which has been given to the Minister of Telecommunications, proposing this hybrid model where both the WoWAN and further exclusive use spectrum is allocated to the operators. You talk about the national 5G network. Let's say Vodacom, for example, gets access to the exclusive use spectrum. They've made the commitment to build to purchase 30% of the capacity from the WOAN. But it's now got the exclusive use spectrum. Surely they're going to go out and they're going to build 4G, 5G networks using that exclusive use spectrum, which they've been assigned because they believe that they can build a better network than what's going to be built through this consortium. And therefore, you end up anyway with infrastructure competition and you don't get the benefit of the efficiencies that you've been talking about.
Well, that's entirely up to them. You know, what the WOAN document does say is that sufficient spectrum would be allocated to the WOAN, right? And therefore, you leave some spectrum behind for certain operators who still want to do their own. Mm. That's their choice. That's their prerogative. Mm. And if they still want to build it in certain areas or certain metro areas, fantastic. That's their prerogative. But we keep missing, in my view, Duncan, the objective of this. This is not about building good quality networks in the urban areas where we already have services. This is about building a massive broadband network that covers the entire country, that covers the larger part of our population that doesn't have access at an affordable price. That's the challenge.
Why not apply this model then to specific geographic areas?
But we're not saying there's nothing in the document that says we want. I mean, what we're trying to get is a framework and then build on it. I mean, I think this is a 2 to 3 year project, Duncan. I don't think we're going to go out there, or I don't believe it's the ministry's intention to go out there within the next 6 months and have this legislated. I think there's a lot of debate, a lot of, you know, structural issues that have to be, you know, taken into account. And also, I don't think that the spectrum is going to become available in the next 2-3 years. Mm. There's still a long process that has to happen before that spectrum becomes available. So
we're talking about the digital dividend below 1 gigahertz, but there is a pressing need for access to more spectrum, particularly in the urban areas. Do you think in the short term maybe ICASA should go ahead and license spectrum at 2.6 gigahertz?
Sure, they should, but then they should just give it to the 5 incumbents on an equal basis.
Okay. Fine. So you'd support that?
Absolutely.
So WOAN for digital dividend, higher frequencies, give it to the operators?
Correct, but on an equal basis. And don't set a price. Mm-hmm. Say, it is. We've divided it up by 5.
Yeah.
You know, I'm referring to WBS is also there now.
Yeah.
Here's your spectrum. Off you go. Mm. And if you want to put a token price, you know, of a couple of million rand to it, fantastic. Mm. Then go ahead. But don't go and set up a price point that other people can't participate. Mm. And if organizations like Smile do want to come, then divide it by 6.
Mm. Mm.
Then give them a fair chance to participate as well.
The government often refers to Mexico as an example. The Mexicans, though, reserved only the 700 megahertz band for this WOAN project. The 800 megahertz band, the other chunk of digital dividend spectrum, will still be allocated in the normal process. You've spoken about a reasonable amount of bandwidth. How do we define that? How much spectrum should this WOAN get?
Well, at the moment, and I stand to correction, I think there's about 120 and 140 between the 700 and 800.
Sounds right, yeah.
So if you took only the 700 and you apply the same principle as what they did in Mexico, and you left the 800 to then be divvied up between the other operators, it's the same thing. What I've seen in tests, 5G, in my discussions with infrastructure vendors, at 50, 60 megahertz, you really start benefiting from what the 5G technology does. Mm. Then you start experiencing download speeds of over 100 megabits per second. And I think that's the key. It's to define what are you trying to achieve for a consumer. What service do you want to deliver?
Mm.
So I have no fundamental problem at an early stage of this discussion to say, leave the 800 and divvy that up by independent people, independent operators. Mm. But go and build this to try and achieve what we're actually setting out to achieve in this country. And this is why I started the discussion up front, Duncan, to say, let's look about operators, what we want, and then what we as a nation are trying to build.
Mm.
And what is that end objective? Because ultimately, if the consumers are happy, we all, get a return on our investment. Yeah? You can't drop prices. I mean, we're still charging per meg. We should be saying, well, it's a gig price. And in a year's time, we should be saying it's a petabyte price. That's what we should be saying. We're still in the mindset of we're still charging per meg. We've seen the usage go up. It could be threefold greater if the price came down. So we know that consumers want access to the internet. They want access to content. We're the prohibitors of that growth as a result of our pricing. But we can't drop the pricing. And in certain circumstances, we've seen pricing going up and the consumers aren't happy, rightfully so. But we have no alternative if all the input costs are increasing.
Mm. The white paper as it stands, yes. I mean, you've got this Deloitte's crafted document that's been presented to the minister, but the minister has said it on a number of occasions that the white paper is not up for negotiation. It's here just for implementation. And the white paper as it stands says that all future high-demand spectrum will be allocated to the wholesale open access network. Is that, in your view, a bad idea?
Yes, if you've put all your eggs into that one basket, absolutely. Right. And that is why the one document we signed, certainly the one I signed, mm-hmm. says that sufficient spectrum, the original draft said all the spectrum.
Yeah.
And we engaged with the ministry and the DOC, and we said this is not up for discussion. So I understand their view, yes, the white paper, this is how it's going to implement it. No, I don't think so.
Mm.
I think there's very constructive dialogue taking place between the incumbents and the ministry to find a solution and to adjust the white paper. If the white paper had to be implemented as it stands today, I'd have a fundamental problem with that.
Okay.
But in my engagement with the ministry, they are open, they are constructive to find a solution, hence the one document that was put together.
Okay, so you're encouraged by the feedback you're getting from the ministry.
Yes.
And you believe that they are listening seriously to what the industry is telling them and that there will be changes to the white paper.
I really, really believe that, you know, the other incumbents will see the benefit of what we're trying to achieve, and there will be, let's call it a hybrid model, and a solution that will be found.
Mm. Okay. If there isn't a solution, I presume this is all going to court.
Well, I think we're all going to go to court and sue each other. That's my honest opinion. I mean, because no one is happy.
I mean, can we avoid court?
I believe so. I mean, in the recent discussions I've had, you know, with the ministry and the DOC, I see positive. Even with the discussions I've had with the other incumbents, I see a totally different tone as opposed to 3 months ago. You know, I see a tone of, yep, some things make sense, some things don't.
Mm.
How do we fit in? You know, and ultimately, I do believe if you look forward, you know, into the world, and we just forget infrastructure for a minute, what are we really competing for? You know, everyone says the share of the wallet of the consumer, but how does the consumer spend money? It spends money on services that he or she likes.
Mm.
So I see a totally different world of services. Networks are becoming... It's not an aggregator. I've always said you're a dumb pub, you know, and you've got to provide a great network. But if you compete on the service level, you compete on the quality level, it gives you a totally different outlook in life of who you as a network would be, because consumers are using our networks to access services that in some cases are making more money than networks.
Mm. No. Where do you fall in that, maybe as a little aside, where do you fall in that debate? I mean, we've seen last year or the year before last, how the operators went to Parliament and there was a lot of debate about so-called over-the-top services and calls for over-the-top services to be regulated. There seem to be two views. One, the big incumbent operators seem to believe that they need to play in that space as well, that it's a non-negotiable, that their margins, they need to do this to maintain their margins going into the future as the world moves from voice to data. The other flip side of the coin, and one perhaps shared by some smaller operators, is that operators should just get used to their future life as dumb pipes. Where do you fall in this debate? What is the future of the operator?
Well, you know, I've just come back from Europe recently, 3-4 weeks ago, where I sat with quite a few other business people who run networks in Europe. And this is a massive, massive debate taking place. And they're taking a tremendous amount of strain in terms of the earnings because, you know, prices are coming down. There's a lot of consolidation. You've seen what's happened in India with Vodafone consolidating. There's a lot of talk of Orange, et cetera, et cetera. So they're under pressure to maintain their earnings and maintain their margin. When it comes to, let's just use the term over the top, I think operators are reluctant to understand how you monetize over the top services. And I've always been of the view that you have to partner with these people and understand where they're going. This is the fact of life, Duncan. Okay, this is what consumers want. This is what they will use. Okay? It's a question of where do we as an operator fit in? I wake up in the morning more concerned about the deployment of Wi-Fi and how we play a role, you know, with these organizations as I do about my other two incumbents in the country. You know, if I take a 4, 5, 6 year view and I look at that infrastructure rollout of Wi-Fi and how that's becoming readily available, and people are using our networks less when they get home, whether they have fiber to home, whether there's more hotspots, and the level of service of those hotspots are becoming better, that keeps me awake at night. Okay? And that's why I'm so for building this massive network that we all compete on the same level playing field on accessing your network. You can't carry on the way you are. This is my view. I sit at the moment as we are a network provider. We have our own infrastructure in the metropolitan areas. We roam on another network. So we monetize that very well at this point in time. We're fighting for the future. And as I said, this is a 2 or 3 year project. I don't think you're going to wake up tomorrow and have this massive network. So you probably will only see this materialize, if all goes well, 5 years from now in sort of a high top, high level time frame. But we are very for getting close to, let's use the term again, to stay constant, over the top players. So we have very good relationships with Facebook. We develop a lot of things with WhatsApp. We're looking at a whole lot of new services that we potentially could bring that are unique to this country and how we package them. And you can't disregard that. You can't keep saying, well, I'll just have this infrastructure and I'll just sweat the asset. You've got to look at, in my view, certainly how the world is turning. And we've been, you know, fat cats for long, network operators around the world. You know, we've had our 20-year great growth, huge margins, good EBITDA, and now you've got to think out the box. I don't think it's going to be plain sailing, you know, the next 3, 4 years, not only in South African terms, but in European or American terms.
So is it a low-margin future for operators?
Not necessarily. If you say low-margin just as a network operator, I think, you know, what we've seen in Europe, America, you're all racing downhill to get to zero quickly. So I think the investors are bullish, but nervously bullish, if I can use that term. One has to be careful that you don't get into that situation. Of course, the dominant people, specifically in South Africa, are saying, well, I want all the spectrum, I want to buy it all, and then I'll do what I want. And I mean, we only talk about the negative of this white paper. Let's look at what happened in India. One operator went, bought all the spectrum. The price was so high that only one individual could buy it. They bought it, and look what they did. Now you got all the other companies trying to merge. So how did that help the consumer in India? Didn't. Okay, so there's the other adverse side. I think we got to understand what our social issues are in South Africa and build a model that works for us.
Let's come back to the white paper and let's talk about some other aspects of it. There's a very strong emphasis on open access in the white paper. Not only when it comes to the wholesale open access network, but open access across the industry and applied also to the mobile networks infrastructure. Does this concern you?
Well, again, Duncan, it concerns me in the way it's sort of written at the moment. I think you have to find that common ground and let's sort of stick to the hybrid model. And I think that's what the WAN does. You know, if you leave it as it is, yeah, then there is a concern in terms of how it's going to be managed and how it's going to work and how it's going to be regulated. But if you look at what we're trying to achieve as an industry, then I'm quite comfortable the way going forward.
You know, should anyone be able to get access to your infrastructure on a wholesale basis?
Yeah, why not? They do already through MVNOs. We just got to refine the model.
Right. Okay.
So if you embrace what Celsius has done, you know, we have, I made an announcement recently that Leica Mobile is launching, you know, June, July. You know, we have a great partnership with Mr. Price, FNB. So in essence, you're already there.
Yeah.
They have access to my infrastructure at a wholesale price.
It's your competitors that need to catch up in that wholesale market.
Well, maybe they just shouldn't, and then I'm okay. You know, benefiting from what we're doing.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was network neutrality, that old chestnut. The white paper has taken a hard line on network neutrality. What's your view?
Again, you know, this debate has been going on for how long, specifically in Europe? And where's the benefits of, you know, net neutrality? You know, that the networks have been saying it's disadvantaged towards us. I mean, has it really been disadvantaged? Will it really be disadvantaged to us? I think there's a lot of statements being made and a very few studies of what the impact is, certainly in this country. I mean, I haven't seen a study that's been produced on the impact of net neutrality. My view, I mean, Duncan, and I'll probably get criticized for this, you know, the MTRs are coming up, you know, for renew in October this year. I think you should have zero terminating fee. You know, I've seen successful countries in Europe who took that approach, and it's been phenomenal.
You know? Take it right down to 0 cents?
No. There's no cost to terminate on your network. And if you really want to get petty about it, then you'll put a fraction of a cent so that you have an income coming in and going out. That brings a whole level of competition into the market. You know, we've had our symmetry. We'll probably fight to increase the symmetry or have it the same or leave it the same. But if you really want to create, you know, a competitive environment, bring it down to naught. I mean, the networks are pretty much now at the same stable. That would give a company like WBS the incentive to say, I'll play in the voice space. You know, at the moment, from what we hear, is they're saying it's just a data network. But if it was not, maybe they'll say, well, we'll play in the voice space as well.
There are underlying costs, though, in terms of connecting between networks.
There are costs. But, you know, you're now in a mature market, and, you know, you should only have a cost for a new incumbent. And that's what we fought about, and we won. So if there's a new incumbent, then give them a little bit of an MTR to terminate on their network. But so as you get your market share and as you get your revenues, you should be sort of not paying any terminating rate to each other. Isn't this the...
Are you required by law to terminate with other networks? Or do you do it voluntarily?
Well, I'm not sure if there's a law.
But it's in the interest of your customers.
Absolutely, yes. So I'm not sure about the law. But from a customer point of view, of course, yes. You want them to terminate on any network.
I mean, the worry would be that if you take termination rates to 0 cents, then some operators might say, well, we're not going to bear that cost.
Well, you know, what is the real cost when you look at it? Because as the market becomes more mature, in other words, in our case, where we're now sitting at 14-15% revenue, then, you know, do we really need to have a cost between the operators? I'd say if there's no cost, then I can be more competitive. If there is a cost, then I want the symmetry.
Yes.
And that's the debate that we'll see now building up to October.
Asymmetry, of course. Yes. I mean, the argument could be made, I suppose, that asymmetry has been quite useful in aiding competition. I'm sure Vodacom and MTN will argue the opposite. But, you know, you can make probably quite a strong argument that asymmetry has actually been beneficial in helping smaller players to compete. If you take the MTR down to 0 cents, then you can't apply asymmetry, and therefore it may be more difficult to introduce new competition.
You would have asymmetry to the new incumbent. So just to make my point clear.
Yeah.
And let's just leave the four incumbents. I still believe there should be a symmetry for Telkom and Cell C, right? So then you say there's a cost.
Yeah.
It's just that my cost is less than the big incumbents, right?
Right.
So that's probably one argument that we'll go through. The other argument is there is no cost amongst us because we're pretty established, but there has to be some asymmetry for any new incumbent. So if the cost is naught amongst certain, let's call it revenue share or percentage revenue share, there's a naught cost. And new incumbents, we'd pay them to terminate on their network.
Right.
So there's still an asymmetry level. You'd always have to give the new incumbents.
The flow would just be one way. There'd be no flow the other way.
Yes, you have to give people an incentive. You know, when I say people, new incumbents. That's what got Cell C really back on track.
Yeah.
You know, in 2013 when we got that asymmetry put in, which should have been put in place in 2001, if you recall. But, you know, that's a debate. So you say net neutrality, well, why even bother? I mean, terminate where you want to terminate and then compete. Why are we trying to protect a patch?
Yeah. When I say network neutrality, I'm thinking more along the lines of internet traffic and less than voice. The argument is that if you introduce network neutrality, that all traffic has to be treated the same. You're going to end up with distortions in price and that sort of thing because at the moment you can create a differentiated service, sell to one corporate an internet service that has certain guaranteed speeds and throughputs and that sort of thing, which you won't be able to do in a strong network neutrality environment.
Well, but that's the argument that I support. I mean, you shouldn't have a differentiator. You should go and compete on the service that you provide and the quality of service that you offer to that. You know, corporate or business.
But a corporate will go to Internet Solutions and buy a dedicated link that has guaranteed uptime, guaranteed throughputs, guaranteed a lot of guarantees built around that connection. There's a quality of service built around that connection, whereas Joe Soap is on a prepaid connection, perhaps shouldn't expect to get that same level of quality of service that a that First National Bank might get from internet solutions.
Why not?
Well, there's a much higher cost in providing that link to First National Bank as to providing, say, a best effort mobile service to a consumer spending 20 rand a month.
So you're saying penalize the man in the street?
Yes, because he's paying less.
Yeah, look, Duncan, this debate has been going on for years, and I don't
think
there's...
We're not going to resolve it today.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a solution anytime soon.
Mm.
You know, but, you know, it's the same argument about over-the-top players. Well, regulate them, you know.
Yeah.
So how would you regulate them? Then they go back to the net neutrality and say, well, penalize them.
Mm.
If you're going to use that service, there's a different cost differentiator.
I suppose my question at the end of the day comes down to, should we be regulating these things, or should we be allowing the market to sort itself out and determine what the right price is for the right type of service?
Well, you know my view, you know.
No, I don't. What is it?
More competition, you know. I think that you need an element of regulation at the wholesale level.
Mm-hmm.
But at the retail level, you need more competition, and people, you know, will decide what the price is. The consumer demand will actually determine what you should be paying for that service and that price.
But network neutrality, therefore, must surely be a bad idea.
It is a bad idea.
It is.
That's what we're saying, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Okay. No. Okay. 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 All right. Is there anything else in the white paper that troubles you?
Not really, Duncan. I mean, there's a lot of things there that are on draft format.
Okay.
And I think the legal experts and the regulatory experts will work through it. I think the big framework we get in there, from my perspective, it was a huge achievement with all the incumbents, all the other operators and the ministry to get to where we signed a document that sets out a different framework, a framework that I think is achievable, and all the other things, you know, they will get addressed as the process goes through.
Mm.
So I'm not too concerned about many other aspects in there.
Okay. Jose, just lastly, I'd like to get your views on the state of the industry. We're obviously in a very difficult economic environment. Consumers are under a lot of pressure, and I'm sure your customers, particularly in the prepaid environment, are feeling that pressure. You and your competition must be feeling the weak economy. But how bullish are you about where we're going as an industry? Do you think there needs to be further consolidation in the space, or do you think the level of competition is right? I mean, you were saying that there could actually be more competition in this market from a service perspective. But just given where we are at the moment as an industry, what could we be doing better? Where would you like to see the telecom space in South Africa, say, 5 years from now?
Yeah, look, we've debated at length about the infrastructure sharing, so let's not go there.
Sure.
I mean, you know my views on how we can really bring the cost down and pass that back into consumers. I think economically speaking, what the government needs to do is say, well, if we've got another 2-3 years to get out of the situation we're in, how do we play in the telco space and other industries? So in our space, you know, is looking at duties of handsets and devices.
Mm.
How do we bring more affordable smartphones to the masses to give them access to the connectivity? You know, we still don't have, you know, 50% of the consumers don't have smartphones. How do you get there? What do you need to do? Remove certain duties, give people certain dispensations. And the telco space is a massive contributor to the economy. And I don't think that we really collectively as a government, as an industry, sitting down and say, how do we help get out of this economic situation?
Mm.
We are a big contributor. We continue to see revenue growth. We'll continue to see that over. But I don't think we've sat down collectively between the private and public sector in the telco space, like maybe other industries have done, you know, the mining industry, the manufacturing industry, financial services. I don't think we've sat down and said, how do we play a role? How do we make it better to ensure that, you know, we're part of this economic growth going forward? I'm bullish about the telco space. I think that, you know, if the CEOs and management of the various operators don't sit down and really start looking carefully about, you know, how do they consolidate the infrastructure, how they become more efficient, the costs will continue to increase, which will mean I don't foresee in the near future massive price reductions going down as, you know, consumers wanted to be, or, you know, as maybe Parliament wants the operators to reduce pricing more effectively. And that there poses a risk because you'll stifle growth. There's only so much money consumers, you know, have access to spend on data or voice. Therefore, you know, you will potentially put yourself into a huge problem. But from a country's point of view, I think, you know, we got a 18-month, two-year you know, sort of difficult time to get the economy back going and to get the confidence, you know, in terms of what we need to do as a nation and really build this economy again. So it'll be a tough 2 years, but the industry needs to be more proactive on how we manage that. And that is why I'm so for this infrastructure, you know, sharing sort of model through a WAN. And we need to get to the end of this discussion quickly, get it legislated, and then start implementing it. And if we drag our heels, then it's a 4 to 5 year process. If we're proactive, it could become a 3 year process. And those are the real issues. So, you know, countries go through ups and downs. Our economy at the moment is not in great shape, but it will come out of it like we have in the past. The telco industry, there's a lot of people that should be having sleepless nights.
In what respect?
Well, you need to change. You know, I mean, if you look at what's happening in the world, and there is references of companies in the telco space that have totally changed their views of how they position themselves in the market, and they've gone from 4 to number 1. And you've seen the old traditional telcos who were number 1 being number 4. We're in a good space, Duncan. I mean, consumers can see some really exciting stuff coming out of Celsius in the months to come. But I think there's a lot of operators there all that really need to say, you know, if we continue the way we are, then we're going to have some challenges.
Just lastly, Jose, Cell C has always been seen as a bit of the consumer champion in the telco market in South Africa. Although you did take some quite serious flack over your price increases earlier this year. Can you continue to be a consumer champion and run a profitable business?
Yeah, I think, you know, being a consumer champion comes with a lot of responsibility. And, you know, we always try and give our consumers the best value. It's absolutely unfortunate that we had to put a price increase, you know, but we've debated why these things happen and why I think on the other hand they could decrease. We will continue, and you'll see in the coming weeks, not months, that we'll continue to add value at an affordable price, and we will continue to drive efficiencies down. And that's the objective, yeah. So, you know, whether you want to say we're a consumer champion, whether we are value-added service provider, whether we continue to bring, you know, the most creative or affordable products in the market, that's what we strive for, you know, coupled with, you know, excellent service. This is what we're striving to achieve. I think we've made great strides to get there. We've got a long way to go. And it's really about, you know, creating a package to a segment of the market that sees that value. And whether we then positioned it as a consumer champion, our objective is to bring, you know, that affordability down to a level that is more attractive to consumers. And there's only so much you can do before you erode margins and you erode profitabilities, and then your investors get upset, and then that's a different debate. So we have to play that fine balance.
Jose Dos Santos is Cell C CEO. Jose, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to Tech Central.
Duncan, thank you. It's been a great pleasure, and I hope it was worth it and informative.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you.